You know, 9/11, obviously, it impacted, I think, everyone somehow, some ways. Going through my brother's experience and the tragedy that he experienced, being able to self-reflect on what I was doing at that moment and realizing that I had a passion for football really triggered this whole thing. Now to be here as part of the New York Jets and knowing that our first game is a day after the 20th anniversary, I mean, I'm supposed to be here, and I believe that.
That's the new Jets head coach, Robert Saleh, speaking to the New York media for the first time. The former 49ers defensive coordinator has been a hot coaching candidate for several years now. But his journey to New York in specific is as unusual as it is groundbreaking. Today, ESPN Jets reporter Rich Cimini tells us how September 11th, 2001 changed Robert Saleh's life forever and set him on a course to become the first Muslim head coach in NFL history. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Wednesday, January 27th. This is ESPN Daily. So, Rich, you are the Jets beat reporter for ESPN. And how many years have you been covering this franchise?
Pablo, I've covered the Jets for 32 years, which is longer than any person in history. I'm not sure if that deserves a Purple Heart or, you know, a trip to the insane asylum. But yes, it's in 32 years.
So how many coaches, how many head coaches have you seen come through the New York Jets in that time?
Yeah, it's funny because the other day before they introduced Robert Saleh, I went back and checked, you know, because when you cover it that long and the Jets change coaches so often, you lose track over time. But the answer is 12 total.
Man, okay, so you are the perfect person to talk to today. Your latest piece, Rich, is about number 12, Robert Saleh, and his decidedly unique journey to New York City and the NFL coaching ranks. So before we get into all of the football, and there is so much there, tell me a little bit about Robert Saleh's background. Where did he grow up, and what was his upbringing like?
Well, Robert grew up in Dearborn, Michigan, which is just outside of Detroit. Most people know it as the home of Ford Motor Company, but it's also the largest percentage of Arab Americans in the country. He is the grandson of a Lebanese immigrant. He grew up in a Muslim neighborhood, a very strong and closely knit neighborhood, and football was a big part of it. Robert really has football in his family. His dad played at Eastern Michigan University. He was, I'm told, a very good middle linebacker. In fact, he had a tryout with the Chicago Bears. He had uncles who played, cousins who played, his older brother David played, all at Fortson High School. You mentioned the Saleh name at Fortson High School, and there is a strong tradition. Some of the best players in the school's history are members of the Saleh family. From an early age, when Robert was a seven-year-old water boy for his older brother's football team, football has been a huge part of his life, the family's life, very much a part of his upbringing in Dearborn, Michigan.
So Robert is growing up in this Lebanese-American Muslim family in Dearborn, a football family. What kind of player was Robert himself?
Yeah, very good player. A captain in high school, played two ways. He was a linebacker and a tight end, and, you know, really good. I talked to his high school coach, Jeff Sturgalis, and I asked him, I said, what kind of player was Robert? He said he was like all the other Salas. He could really hit you. He actually wears a bracelet to this day on his wrist during games. It says extreme violence. So I guess we could describe him as a very physical player who was good enough to get a scholarship to Northern Michigan. And he went on to become an all-conference tight end at Northern Michigan. I mean, no, I don't think the NFL was ever a serious option for him, but I would say, you know, a really good high school football player who enjoyed a solid college career.
So if you're a football player with that decidedly unsubtle mission statement, Rich, what do you do after college?
Robert went to the exact opposite spectrum of what that mission statement would be. I mean, he goes to work behind a desk, working a 9-to-5 job in a very stuffy corporate office building in downtown Detroit as a credit analyst for Comerica Bank, putting his finance degree to work. His brother, David, is in the financial world as well. You know, he graduated with a finance degree. So this is just, you know, following in the footsteps of his family. You know, his dad had done some business work. His grandfather was actually owned his own furniture store in Dearborn. So he's really Robert Saleh, at this point in his life in the year 2000, just out of college, is just following in the footsteps of some of his other relatives.
So let's get to 2001, because he's working at this bank in Michigan. He's not long out of college. And then September 11th happens. What was that day like for Robert Saleh?
Well, that day, and I talked with his dad and his brother David in depth on this, you know, they're gathered in the Saleh living room in Dearborn, Michigan, watching the horror unfold on CNN. And his dad described it in vivid detail. The whole family's there. It's his wife. She's crying. His two daughters are crying. Robert is there sitting on a couch, just motionless, staring at the screen. Them all knowing that David, who's a couple of years older than Robert, is in the South Tower on the 61st floor working as a trainee for Morgan Stanley.
What are David Saleh's memories of that day?
David told me that about 8:30 in the morning, he took a little coffee break. He walked from his desk over to one of the windows on the 61st floor of the South Tower. He looks out to admire the view, much like a tourist would. He said he'd never been that high before in his life. He looks down. He sees the Statue of Liberty. He looks in the harbor on this picture-perfect day. He sees all the boats in the harbor. And then all of a sudden, this fireball just zooms by the window. He said it came by with such force and it was so jarring that it actually threw him back a step. He didn't know what it was, but he figured to himself, I got to get out of here.
So what did he do?
He said he started walking down the stairwell, 61 floors down. He said to this day, he's haunted by an image on the 11th floor. He went past the firefighters who were making their way up. And he says the look on one firefighter's face to this day is just burned in his memory. He said you could just tell that this firefighter had a real look of concern as they were walking up into this great inferno. And so he got out of the building. And he said he just started sprinting and he still didn't know what was happening. He didn't know until a little bit later that it was a plane that hit the towers. He stopped, looked back, along with, you know, hundreds of thousands of other people looking back. And he said it was like a scene from the movie Independence Day, just people staring up at this horrific scene. He goes, let me tell you, Rich, he goes, you never, ever want to hear a voicemail from your mother's voice calling you and leaving a message, not knowing if you're dead or alive. He goes, because that's what my mother did before she was able to reach me. She left a voicemail and she was, of course, hysterical, like any mother would be. And he goes, that is a voice in a situation you never want to be in.
So eventually, David is able to get in touch with his family back in Dearborn, Rich, and he lets them know that he's okay. But how did that day affect Robert in particular?
Well, his dad gave me a play-by-play. He said Robert didn't move. He goes, everybody else in the room was crying, and Robert was just emotionless, staring at the screen, watching this unfold. And in retrospect, that was a turning point in his career path. He realized, look, life is too short. My brother's going through this harrowing experience. I'm doing a job in finance I don't even like. I got to do what my passion is, and my passion is football. But the thing is, Pablo, no one knew for another 5 months, and so he carries this burden with him. And then one day, it's early February. In fact, it was the day after the Super Bowl when the Patriots shocked the Rams. He calls up his brother, and he's hysterical crying on the phone. David answers the phone. His brother is sobbing uncontrollably. And he says to David, David, I can't do this anymore. This is not me. I got to get back. Got to get back into football somehow. So that was the turning point.
So this epiphany that he has post 9/11, that he has to actually go and chase the thing he actually loves. How did he explain that to the rest of the family, to his parents?
That was not easy. So he drives home to Dearborn and he knocks on the door. You know, his dad invites him in, and his dad says he walks in the door and he goes, his face was as red as a tomato. And the dad says to him, Robert, did you get fired? He goes, no, I didn't get fired, Dad. He goes, here's the story. And he explains to him that his heart is not into this job and he wants to quit. And so like any dad would say, and I'm sure I'd react the same way if my son did it, you know, Robert, are you sure you want to leave? This is a good job, Robert. You're making $800 a week. You have a chance for growth. You know, finance is an excellent field. It's safe. It's secure. You want to go into coaching? Coaching is such an unstable business. So he's doing everything he can to talk Robert out of this career change. And Robert is like, Pops, I'm sorry. This is what I have to do. I have to get involved in football. And his father, you know, kept on trying to change his mind. And finally, his father came to the realization he was not going to change Robert's mind. He goes, okay, I'm behind you. Do what you got to do. Our door is always open. We'll support you.
So Robert works his way through the college ranks, and he eventually makes it to the NFL in 2005. What happens there, Rich, and what makes him successful to the point where he keeps on climbing and climbing and climbing the NFL ladder?
Yeah, so he's at the Houston Texans, and, you know, he spends 5 years there, and he does a really good job as a quality control coach, which is basically you're doing the grunt work. You know, you're reproducing scouting reports, you're working in a dark film room, writing down plays on file cards, but he impresses the coaches. In fact, one day, the defensive coordinator from the Houston Texans, a guy named Richard Smith, went up to Robert's father, Sam, at practice one day. He was visiting, and he said, Sam, why is Robert in the NFL? He goes, he should be a college professor. He's really smart. He's too smart for the NFL. He has the ability to take really complicated information that ordinarily would confuse players. He has the ability to simplify it, present it in a really clear and concise manner that allows players to go on the field and play fast and not have to be burdened by thinking too much. Now, coaching in its purest form is teaching. And from what they tell me, Robert is a really good teacher. That should translate well to the Jets because they have such a young team. I think teaching will be very important.
All right, Rich, coming up after the break, I need to ask you how Robert Saleh plans on turning around this franchise and this culture that you know so well, and how he might finally build a winner for the first time in what feels like forever.
Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot. Taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut, or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
Rich, it is really, really hard to get anything close to like universal bipartisan praise for the Jets, but the praise for this hire does seem like it is universal. You have players who use the coach, like Richard Sherman tweeting, the New York Jets got a great one. You have current players on the Jets, like Quinnen Williams, just celebrating. And the Jets, notably, also own the longest active playoff drought in the NFL, thanks to the Browns making the playoffs. The Jets last qualified in 2010. So what about Robert Saleh makes everybody seem to think that he can do the unthinkable and actually turn this team into a contender?
Yeah, it is amazing. I can speak from experience having covered so many coaching changes. Very rarely do you get a choice that is universally praised like the Saleh hiring was. I didn't hear any criticism. I talked to a bunch of people around the NFL. No one had anything bad to say about Robert. And mind you, 2 years ago when they hired Adam Gase, it was very criticized. You know, I talked to people around the league and they're saying, what are the Jets doing? And the fans were upset. There was not a peep of criticism. And I think Christopher Johnson, the Jets CEO, was kind of surprised by that. I know he told people that this was their most popular hiring since Bill Parcells in 1997. So we're going back a ways. I mean, he's qualified. He's got an upbeat personality, which is what you need when you have such a losing culture. So it remains to be seen, though, whether he can put it all together.
So the culture that Adam Gase is leaving behind, and Gase, obviously, from the press conference and from the darting of the eyes, he became this caricature. Sala seems to be something very different. It seems like there is a popularity, but also an energy to him that people, players in specific, really take to. How would you describe just his mien, how he carries himself around players?
Well, there's really two kinds of Robert, just from talking to all the people who know him. On Sunday, we've seen him. He's exuberant on the sideline. He high-fives players. He's not shy about showing his enthusiasm.
Murray's pass is batted down by Warner. Fred Warner runs right over to the sideline where Robert Saleh goes up high to greet him.
I think fans can relate to that. I think the fans embrace that sort of behavior because the Jets are coming off 6 straight years of coaches who remained stoic on the sideline. They had 4 years of Todd Bowles, who was emotionless on the sideline, and then it was the same with Adam Gase. So they see a coach who's excited, who's having fun, and that connects to the fan base. Monday through Saturday, they tell me that Robert is completely different. He's completely calm. He's a deep thinker. I found this out. I thought it was fascinating. He's a really good chess player. He's an 1800 level chess player. And I admittedly had no idea what that was, but I looked it up. That's pretty high on the rating system. It's not quite to the master's level, but he's close. And so he's a deep thinker, you know, able to relate to all kinds of players Monday through Saturday. But then on Sunday, gets his game face on. By the way, he runs the stadium steps before every game to burn off some of that energy. He says he's going to continue that tradition even as a head coach. And so the fans are connecting with that. They're really digging that because the fans hated Adam Gase, hated him. I've never seen anything like it in all my years of covering the Jets. And so they're embracing this guy because he seems to really get it.
It seems almost too on the nose, Rich, that the New York Jets' new head coach is a man who literally plays chess instead of checkers. But now the front office does have a bunch of strategic decisions to make. They went 2-14 last year. They earned the second pick in the draft, much to the chagrin of their fans who wanted Trevor Lawrence. But with Lawrence likely now off the table, Saleh's first decision here as a part of the Jets could ultimately be the most meaningful that he'll be a part of. So what could happen here with Sam Darnold and that number two overall pick?
Yeah, great question. I think now, just to be clear, I mean, technically, he does not have the final say on personnel. General manager Joe Douglas has the final call on that. I'm sure he's going to take a lot of input from Robert and his new offensive coordinator, Mike LaFleur, who came with him from the 49ers. And so I've been told, and Robert articulated this at his press conference, and he wasn't just blowing smoke. He really likes Sam Darnold.
He's got an unbelievable arm talent. There's a reason why he was the number three pick in the draft. He's fearless in the pocket. He's got a natural throwing motion. He's mobile. He's extremely intelligent. He's tough as nails.
He thinks Sam has a lot of untapped potential in spite of his struggles last year. And he thinks that Sam can be fixed just with a scheme change and a coaching change. Now, does that mean they're going to go with Sam Darnold as their quarterback next year? No. There's a lot that goes into that decision. As you mentioned, they have the number two pick. There's a couple of really good quarterback prospects in this draft. Justin Fields from Ohio State, Zach Wilson from BYU. The Jets could go in that direction, in which case they would trade Sam Darnold. Or, this is the ultimate wild card, Deshaun Watson is very close to asking for a trade. And if he does, do the Jets jump into that mix? I think they absolutely should jump in. It's a rare opportunity to get a franchise quarterback in his prime. Whether they will or not, I can't say for sure. But this quarterback question will not be solved until, I think, the night of the draft in late April.
You've been covering this team for 32 years, Rich. You know better than any other human being in our business how different it is to coach this team in this city. And I know Jets fans are listening to you right now, and there is that optimism and hope, and also there's the inner core of them that's already booing the defensive lineman the Jets are going to pick in their mind's eye. So tell me about how Robert Saleh, you think, might handle all of the extra stuff, all of the pressure, all of that heat from the spotlight that is the city of New York and this job in particular.
Well, the good thing that he'll have is he's going to get a legitimate honeymoon. Adam Gase had no honeymoon whatsoever because of that I don't even know what the bizarre opening press conference sort of confirmed in the fans' eyes that he was not the right guy. And then when you start 0-7 in your first year, or actually they were 1-7, that's not good. So Robert will have a honeymoon, which is going to benefit him. And it takes a strong personality. You can't emphasize that enough. This is a franchise that, except for a couple of fleeting moments of success, they've basically gone 52 years without a Super Bowl. Joe Namath is still their most famous player. Him walking off the field at the Orange Bowl, wagging that "we're number one" sign, is still the most iconic visual in the franchise history. It is so long ago. The fans today, you know, most of them weren't even alive. You know, they only see that moment on YouTube. So he has a monumental task in changing that. I would suggest to him that he gets off to a good start in September. That would help. And just getting the players to buy in, which is something that Adam Gase was not able to do.
So the start of that season in September that you just referenced, Rich, it's going to be September 12th, 2021. That means that Robert Saleh will most likely officially begin his career as the first Muslim head coach in NFL history the day after the 20th anniversary of 9/11. How significant do you think that is for Robert Saleh?
Very significant on many levels, and I would suspect the NFL will absolutely give the Jets a home game. The NFL will not miss a storyline like that. It's so perfect. It's always a solemn anniversary in New York anyway, but the fact that it's the 20th and a football game and a Muslim American head coach, I mean, that is a jam-packed storyline. And from MetLife Stadium, you can actually see the lower Manhattan skyline. So it's a perfect backdrop. And I know Robert talked about the meaning of it in his introductory press conference.
It's humbling. And, you know, especially back home where I'm from, Dearborn, Michigan. So there's a lot of pride. And so it is a very humbling experience. And you know, when you look at NFL organizations and you look at the locker room, and it's like the ultimate melting pot of different people and different races and different stories that get together with one goal. And so to be a part of that is special.
Rich, after 32 years of service covering this team, thank you for helping the city of New York look forward to number 33.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Up next, Dominique Foxworth explains why a league that has so many black players has hired zero black head coaches so far this year.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home some huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Here's another story I want you to know. Hiring season in the NFL kicked off with 7 head coaching vacancies. And now there's only one job that remains open with the Houston Texans. So it feels time to do a bit of accounting. Because last May, the league had expanded the Rooney Rule, the policy designed to promote the hiring of minority candidates. But of the 6 men hired to fill those 6 head jobs, only one, Robert Saleh, the Lebanese-American subject of today's show, was a non-white hire. Which means that in a league whose players are 70% black, there are only 2 black head coaches, down from 3 last year. So I called our friend Dominique Foxworth, the retired NFL cornerback and head of the NFL Players Union and alumnus of Harvard Business School, to discuss. So Dominique, as you look around at the list of these NFL head coaches, besides Robert Saleh, we're looking at Nick Sirianni in Philly, Dan Campbell in Detroit, Brandon Staley with the Chargers, Arthur Smith in Tennessee, Urban Meyer in Jacksonville. This is not exactly the rainbow coalition that last year's expansion of the Rooney Rule had promised. So how did all of this happen?
Racism. You could say it's structural or individual. I think people like to use the word bias because it feels a little bit more comfortable, but this bias is based on race and the people who are making the decisions. We thought that maybe we could encourage them through some sort of compensation to be a little more open-minded and a little less biased, but that hasn't seemed to work in the past couple of years. It seems like it's gotten worse. And I'm willing to accept that part of it is structural, which, or institutional, which would mean that it's not people making malicious decisions. But it's hard to deny that it's not also individual with the decision makers when you look at some of the people that are being hired. Because for so many years, we heard the reason why there weren't very many black head coaches was because there weren't enough in the pipeline. Now we have a situation where there are plenty within the pipeline. But I mean, you can say Eric Bieniemy, Todd Bowles, Marvin Lewis, Gerard Mayo, Raheem Morris, Jim Caldwell, Leslie Frazier, Aaron Glenn, Patrick Graham. They're all guys who have had interviews this year. So the pipeline is full. But in the last several years, I guess probably since McVay was hired, it feels like the owners and the teams are much more comfortable with going outside of the pipeline. So it just makes it frustrating when they say that there's one bar that you have to meet and then things will change. You meet that bar and then they go and hire people who wouldn't have traditionally met that bar. And those guys get opportunities while the black coaches who have, air quotes, paid their dues are still going on interviews. You have a guy like Bieniemy, which people find reasons to denigrate his resume, like saying, well, he was with Andy Reid. But then you look around at other guys who were offensive coordinators like Nagy and Peterson, who at different points were co-offensive coordinators. So not only was Andy Reid the head coach, but they had to share the title of offensive coordinator, but they go get head coaching jobs when you have Eric Bieniemy, who's had possibly the best offense that we've ever seen, continually do it in back-to-back years, and he doesn't get the credit. People are like, oh, but Andy Reid's the decision maker. He's the play caller.
So it is unfair for me to ask you, hey, how do we fix this? Because there has been this effort collectively to incentivize, to shame, to report, and clearly nothing has really taken. So is there anything else to do about this? Let me put it that way.
I think you need new owners, frankly. And the NFL, the same way that they groom head coaches or groom general managers, they're probably even more diligent about grooming the next owners. Normally, you come into a minority ownership situation before you actually get a chance to buy a team. I think about Al Davis as someone who wasn't even the majority owner of his team for most of the time that he so-called owned the Raiders. So you can be the face of an organization, the guy who makes decisions or the woman who makes decisions in that situation without having billions upon billions of dollars. So I think the decision makers have to be changed because there's no level of incentive that can overcome that bias. We just need to find a way to get them to see minority coaches in the same light, or Black coaches specifically, in the same light that they see all these young, soon-to-be Sean McVay coaches that continuously get hired. Not to say that they're not good, because many of them have success, but those are opportunities that Black coaches aren't getting.
So there is precisely one head coaching job left open, and that is in Houston, and you are already cackling. And I have to ask you, Dominique, because look, I love Josh McCown as a podcast guest. I love him as a player. But what went through your mind when you saw the news that the Texans, who were dealing with Deshaun Watson, demanding out on the basis of not having enough say over who is in power of that team? What'd you make of that news that Josh McCown is being interviewed as a head coach?
The only job that is left is the Houston job, which is a terrible job. So I guess I'll be happy if a Black candidate gets it, but I also will be like, that kind of stinks for you. And to the McCown point of it, like when Sean McVay got a head coaching job, I think it was at 32 years old, crazy young. I remember going on SportsCenter and saying, I love it. I'm glad that they are breaking this nonsense around experience and going with someone that they think can do the job. I still felt that way. And I feel the same way about McCown. But it's impossible to separate that from what's happening to these Black coaches. Again, I refuse to allow this situation to put me in a place where I have to like talk bad about these potential candidates or talk bad about McCown. Like I would like to encourage them and root for them, but make it so hard when the bias is so obvious.
Dominique Foxworth, thank you for making it easy for us on ESPN Daily.
You're welcome.
I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.